You're tuned to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. The following program is a rebroadcast of Salvation is from the Jews with Roy Showman.
Hi, this is Roy Showman, and welcome once again to Salvation is from the Jews, the show on Radio Maria that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic faith, or seen the other way around, that celebrates the fulfillment, the completion, the full realization of all of the promise of Judaism in the Catholic Church and its sacraments. Now, today's show is actually a continuation of an interview which I began last week with a Barry Schwartz, also a new Jewish friend of mine, but who had a very special role to play in the investigation of the Shroud of Turin. He was, in fact, the official photographer for the first Shroud of Turin scientific investigation in 1978. He's actually responsible for most of the photographs of the image on the Shroud of Turin, which one sees. The Shroud of Turin, of course, I hope all of our listeners have seen pictures of it, but it is purported to be the burial shroud of Jesus on which a miraculous image of the scourged and crucified Jesus still appears to this day. Anyway, Barry Schwartz is an absolutely top-notch, top-of-his-field scientific photographer, was at the time, and since then, since 1978, when he was first exposed to the Shroud, has become one of the foremost scientific experts on the issues around establishing the authenticity of the Shroud of Turin. He is firmly convinced that the Shroud of Turin could not have been anything other than what it purports to be, that it could not have been counterfeited in any way or fraudulent in any way. But I'll let him speak for himself. We're going to jump into the interview around halfway through. I strongly recommend that if you didn't hear last week's show, you might want to go back and listen to it in the archive on Radio Maria at radiomaria.us. Click on programs along the top and then choose Salvation is from the Jews, and then choose last week's show, or you can also find it on my website, salvationisfromthejews.com. Now, at the point where we are continuing the interview, we're just about to begin speaking about the claim that some make that the Shroud photograph, when magnified, shows coins resting on the eyes of Jesus and coins that date the Shroud to virtually exactly 30 AD or 33 AD. So we're going to pick up with Barry Schwartz talking first about the coins and then about a host of other scientific issues having to do with the Shroud. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, Barry Schwartz is Jewish, and he remains Jewish to this day, although he at the same time has a tremendous reverence both for the man on the Shroud and for the authenticity of the Shroud. So without wasting any more time, let's get to the interview.
So what about the coins on the eyes?
Coins on the eyes. Well, here's the thing. Again, this comes into my field of expertise, but I'm not going to quote Barry Schwartz. I'm going to quote Don Lynn, the man who was head of imaging on Voyager and Viking and Mariner and Galileo and a few others. And he said to me, Barry, it's impossible for them to resolve the inscription on a dime-sized coin because the weave of the cloth is too coarse to resolve something smaller than that. Or in other words, the pixel size is too large to resolve something as small as an inscription on a coin not much larger than a dime. And so it's impossible to resolve that. But when you blow up and you contrast enhance the weave, you've now created a myriad of shapes and patterns, and the eye-brain combination starts filling in the blanks and seeing shapes that look like something they've seen in the past, and that's what they see.
But there were coins on the eyes. It's just that the inscription was not readable, or is it not even clear that there were coins placed on the eyes?
We're not even certain they were coins. They might be coins.
But they're small, because I looked at the VP8,
right, they're not very large.
There's something resting on top of the eyelids, right?
Correct. And historically, particularly in Jewish burial ceremonies, they would use potsherds, broken pieces of pottery. This wasn't so much a religious thing as to just keep the eyes closed, because occasionally the eyes can open depending on the conditions. And so that was very disturbing. They didn't want that, so they would place something over the eyes to keep the lids closed. So that was a normal thing, and that may well be what we have there. When people who have made these claims about identifying a particular coin did so, they determined that the coin they perceived there was a lepton, which is a Roman coin a pagan coin, if you will. And my feeling has always been that these disciples of Jesus, most of whom believed he was, in fact, the Messiah, they wouldn't put a pagan coin on the face of the Messiah. And when I spoke to the gentleman who proposes this theory, he said, oh, they used whatever they had in their pockets. And I said, you know, you obviously don't know that many Jews. I don't think they would have done that. And so, you know, you have these things that are purely speculation. Pareidolia is a part of it. And, you know, it's very frustrating for me because being the photographer and the point guy sort of, you know, that speaks up publicly as much as I do, I get inundated every year with images from people. Look at this. What do you think? And so I've had to come up with two answers. I can give them a scientific answer, which is, you know, well, scientifically there's no veracity to what you're claiming, or I can give them what I call the other answer, and that is simply this. I cannot see through somebody else's eyes, and they cannot see through mine. And if somebody sees something that moves their heart and touches them spiritually, who am I to say that's wrong? So the two answers I can give the scientific answer, which probably disputes what they are claiming, or I can give the other answer, which says, look, if that's what you've seen and it's inspired you or brought you closer to your faith or it has moved your heart, whatever it's done, who am I to dispute that scientifically? I can say, well, look, it's in the eye of the beholder.
But, you know, you're even saying that shows actually, in a sense, the danger of stretching the, quote, science, close quote, too far, because there is scientific evidence. You've been spending most of the show talking about it, scientific evidence that basically – shows some miraculous aspect to the shroud that is not materialistically explainable. And then you have these other things which are debunkable. And so by stirring them together, you undermine the credibility of the basic thesis, which is that there's something miraculous behind the shroud.
Yeah, and you'll find that I won't use the term miraculous myself because I don't believe – remember this. This is important for everybody that's listening. The shroud's only been examined scientifically once ever in its history, and that was 36 years ago. And so we've not ever had the opportunity to apply more modern and refined technologies, especially imaging technologies that now exist, to the shroud. So there's only so much we could learn from the tests that we performed, the data that we gathered, the experiments that we performed. There's only so much we could get from that, and that's old data now. We need new testing and applying new technologies, and perhaps we can answer some of these questions. But I wouldn't yet use the term miraculous, at least not in my mind.
How about totally inexplicable as of now?
Sure. You can use the term miracle, although I'm hesitant to do so yet.
Okay. Well, I didn't need to push you. I was just...
No, that you didn't push me, Roy. Please, not to worry.
But anyway, so in this debunking business, okay, the number one, you know, arrow in the quiver of people who say that the shroud is a forgery is, of course, the carbon-14 dating. So we can't be complete without addressing that.
Sure. And carbon-14 dating is a generally reliable scientific test for approximating the age of an organic object. And, of course, linen cloth is organic. So carbon-14 is an appropriate test for that kind of material. In 1988, three radiocarbon dating laboratories were given the permission to do and perform a radiocarbon dating test on the shroud itself. Unfortunately, when it got down to it, they stood over the cloth for about an hour and a half arguing as to where they should take the sample from. And in the end, they only took one very small sample along the edge of one seam at one corner of the cloth. They took that sample and they cut it in half and put half of it aside as a reserve sample, and they took the remaining half, divided it in thirds by weight, and distributed it to the three different laboratories, Arizona, Zurich, and Oxford. The three labs then went ahead and performed their radiocarbon dating testing on their respective samples, came up with slightly varying dates within a few hundred years of each other, and came out and stated that the shroud could be no older than 1260 to 1390 as the origins of that cloth. That pretty much brought everything to a screeching halt in the world of the shroud, but I have to remind you that our team had performed the tests that we had performed, published our data in peer-reviewed scientific journals, and not these open-access internet journals that we have today where the only thing they review is your check, and if it clears, they publish your work. In those days, we couldn't leak anything to the media, because if anything of our work came out in the media, then the real quality journals wouldn't publish it. So our work was published in the highest quality peer-reviewed journals of the day. And so there's plenty of evidence that supports the claims made by the STIRP team that this cloth isn't a painting, it isn't a photograph, it isn't a scorch, it's none of the things the skeptics claimed, that the image was formed by some mechanism that is yet to be determined. We were able to characterize chemistry and physics, but we could not determine a mechanism to create an image with those chemical and physical properties. So all of that evidence existed when the carbon dating came out. Now, in the real world of science, and you can check with any archaeologist that you might know, that if you are doing an archaeological dig and you find different objects and you decide to date those objects are first characterized based on the level that they're found in the ground with other artifacts that are found at that same level. And if a carbon date on one of those objects comes back and it's completely different than what all the other evidence shows, they discard the carbon date. They don't keep it. It's called an outlier, and they throw it away. They do not use it. In the case of the shroud, they did just the opposite. There was, let's just for arbitrary numbers say, there were 100 pieces of evidence. 99 of them, those coming from our team, pointed towards authenticity. One of them, the radiocarbon date, pointed in the opposite direction, and they threw away all the 99 and kept the one. And that's not the way real science works. And as I say, I've spoken with archaeologists, a number of archaeologists on this, and they all agree that it's not the most reliable thing all the time. So it is sad that this one test, and that's all it was a single test, because they all used virtually the same piece of material, pointed in the direction that they pointed it in. Now,
go ahead. I was going to ask about the patch theory.
Yeah, at the time that the radiocarbon dating came out, you know, that was the only piece of evidence that was not supportive of the authenticity of the shroud. And it was amazing how everybody just immediately discarded all the other evidence in favor of that one, because apparently it fit their personal requirements rather than just telling the truth about the science. Now, let's talk about the radiocarbon dating for a moment. First of all, there is strong evidence in the historic record that shows the Shroud of Turin was in existence way before the radiocarbon dating's earliest possible date. The most prominent of those is something called the Prey Codex, or Prey Manuscript. It's a Hungarian illuminated manuscript still in the museum in Budapest to this day. That's an illustration of the shroud. It shows the herringbone weave. It shows Jesus nude with his arms crossed across his torso like we have on the shroud. And remember this, historically artists always showed Jesus with a modesty cloth, and that's true. But the man on the shroud does not have a modesty cloth, breaking the convention of almost all artworks done throughout history. Nor does the man illustrated in the Prey Codex have a modesty cloth. So there's a relationship there, but most importantly, there's some burn holes in the shroud that predate the fire that caused most of the visible damage on it, and those are sort of shaped like inverted L's. And this monk, probably, who illuminated this manuscript, had obviously seen the shroud. Those L-shaped burn holes would have been the most prominent and visible thing on the cloth at first glance, before you noticed the subtle image, which is only 10 to 15% darker than the background. And he included them in his illustration, and even the orientation is correct. And I think I demonstrate this in my lectures. I actually show this. So there's strong evidence that the earliest possible date the radiocarbon dating guys gave us can't be correct. Now, I'm not a physicist, so I didn't know why there was a problem. And it wasn't until 2000, 12 years later, that two researchers came out with a theory that the radiocarbon dating was perfectly correct. And the only thing that was wrong was the sample chosen for dating. And remember, they only took one sample, so there was not even a point of comparison on one end to the other end of the cloth. It's very hard when you have a 14.5-foot sheet of cloth, 3.5 feet wide, a lot of square footage there, to take one little sample from one little corner and say that represents this entire cloth. So this husband and wife research team, Benford and Marino, they proposed that the sample site had been taken from a rewoven portion of that corner. And they were able to provide evidence from three independent textile experts using photographs of the sample Zurich had been given, that there was some manipulation had been done in that corner by someone very skilled in a technique that we found out is called French invisible reweaving. And ironically, at the time this probably occurred, the shroud was in France, And remembering that the shroud is owned by the Savoy family, the monarchy of Italy, this was perfected at the French court, and it made good sense with the shroud in France that this would be a likely object for them to apply this technique on. There's scientific evidence that has now been published in two different peer-reviewed journals, both of them very highly regarded, that strongly supports the theory that the sample site chosen was a repaired or rewoven area, not a patch, which is a terminology I've chastised Benford Marino for using that term, because it's confusing. There were 30 patches in the shroud from the 1532 fire, and so people often think they must have cut a piece from one of those patches. No, this was a rewoven corner, and there's strong scientific evidence supporting the fact that that corner was anomalous, had been repaired, and did not represent the main body of the shroud cloth. It was anomalous. So to me, that was a much more logical, a much more logical approach than attacking radiocarbon dating or even attacking the scientists who did the radiocarbon dating. But there are some other things that happened that make the question mark even bigger. How about this, that three laboratories were ultimately chosen to do the radiocarbon dating. The three labs were supervised by one man from the British Museum. Okay, so he was sort of in charge of the entire operation and supervised the three laboratories in doing their tests. As soon as the paper came out debunking, and I'm putting that in quotes, the shroud, Oxford, the one of the three laboratories that did the testing, received £1 million anonymous as a contribution for debunking the shroud. And the gentleman from the British Museum left the British Museum, and part of that £1 million contribution funded a permanent chair for him at Oxford. Now, when people say to me, well, gee, does that mean there was a conspiracy? I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that doesn't really smell very good. And it's kind of ironic that these guys benefited personally from an anonymous contribution. And I'm not accusing anybody of anything, but I am asking this question. When did they know they were going to get that £1 million? Did they have any inkling in advance that that might come? And if so, what influence might that have had on their results? You have to ask these questions because these are human beings and they're susceptible to, you know, to the weaknesses that we all have. So, again, I'm not accusing anybody of anything. I'm just saying that there are so many suspicious things that were – just for an example, they argued for an hour and a half over the shroud before they took the samples. Then they cut that little piece from that one corner. Then they left the room – for 30 minutes and came back with sealed stainless steel containers, which means you couldn't see what was in them, instead of glass, which is typical in laboratories. And, you know, why did they leave the room for 30 minutes and then came back with sealed metal containers where you couldn't see what was in them? So what happened in that room? I don't know. I'm not saying anything happened in the room, but the fact that they left the room away from the camera and came back 30 minutes later with sealed non-glass containers.
Right. That's talk about chain of custody.
Yeah, that's bad science. That's just bad science. Yeah. Also, each sample taken for carbon dating was supposed to be chemically analyzed by the laboratories before they burnt the samples, because that's what you do. You burn the samples, catch the gases, and that's what you test for, you know, with your counter there. And yet they didn't do the chemical analysis of the samples, which was in their own protocol. And when they were asked why, they said, well, because we already knew which sample was the one from the shroud. So much for the blind study they were doing. How did they know which sample was from the shroud? Because there was only one herringbone woven sample in the bunch they were each given. All the others were square weave. And so it was really easy to identify. And this was supposed to be a blind study. They weren't supposed to know which one was from the shroud. So right off the bat, there's two parts of their protocol shot away right there.
So, I didn't know that. You don't mention that in your talks. I didn't hear that.
I don't go into this detail in my talks because I don't want to be accused of making accusations about people.
Sure.
And like I said, I pose it simply as a question. Did they know they were going to get that money? And if so, when did they know? And if they knew in advance, what does that do to disqualify them and all their testing right from the beginning?
Now, I saw some photographs. I'm, of course, just a kind of reasonably intelligent layman, but I saw some photographs that I guess were taken in the 78 investigation, which implied that the corner from which the sample was taken was chemically different from the rest of the shroud?
Yes. Those are called the quad mosaics. They were done by Jean Lohr at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. He was another. He was the other team member of STRP from JPL, along with Don Lynn. Jean Lohr, who didn't know about the Benford Merino theories or the work that Ray Rogers was doing to follow up on that, he didn't know about any of that. And so I wrote him and I said, would you explain to me what these mean? Because, you know, he was a hardcore scientist. I wanted to get it in his own words. And he had no knowledge that Benford Merino had claimed, you know, there was an anomaly in the sample that was chosen. So what he wrote back to me was, he says, basically those are chemical maps. And what they do is show different chemical compositions on the cloth. It doesn't tell us what the chemistry is. It just shows a differential because they color code different densities to different chemistries.
Let me just back up because I've seen the photograph. So what they look like is they look like thermal imaging to me, but they're color photographs of all almost, I don't want to say random colors, but oranges and reds and greens and so forth.
Correct.
And the color of in a particular spot on the shroud reflects something about the chemical composition. One doesn't really know what, but one knows that if the chemical composition is the same, it's going to be the same color. So if it's a very different color, it's a different chemistry of the cloth.
Exactly correct, Roy. And that's what you see. Now, what's interesting is this. There's a seam, and to the left of the seam is an area that was cut out probably by the Savoy family to create relics and give them as gifts to other royal families. And so there was a patch sewn in there. Now, that patch is of a different material, and so it was a completely different color than the warmer tone colors, reds and oranges and yellows, that the shroud showed up in. Except that when you cross that seam, that's where the radiocarbon dating sample was taken from, and it's green that gradually goes out to the warmer tones of the shroud. It's a thin band of that, and it's not an evenly shaped band, indicating there's a different chemical composition along that strip that was cut out for dating. And so that is one of the pieces of scientific evidence that indicates a different chemical composition in that sample site. And although skeptics like to poo-poo that because they don't understand what Jean Lohr did, so I had him write it down, and we published that on shroud.com so you can read it. And he knew nothing about any of this. He'd been out of the mix for many years by then. He just explained what he did in those images and what their significance was. Well, they show that the sample site taken and used for radiocarbon dating the shroud was of a different chemical composition to some extent than the rest of that cloth. And that's one strong piece of corroborating evidence right there.
And let me just back up to this invisible reweaving in case some of the listeners don't know. I am old enough to have had a suit invisibly reweaved when I tore a hole in the pants. And it's very subtle. They take threads, they take new threads, and they incorporate them in the old fabric. So it's a gradual transition. So it's completely invisible.
Thread by thread. They actually go thread by thread and replace them, which is why that getting that suit fixed probably cost a lot of money.
Well, it cost less than a suit in those days. I'm sure you can't get it done now for less than the cost of the suit.
Well, ironically, here's the thing, and this is something one of the skeptics has pointed out. Well, look, they reweave things all the time, but we would see on the backside of the cloth the bad, you know, the sort of the loose threads and stuff that you wouldn't see from the front. Because typically when you have something rewoven today, it's perfect on the side that everybody sees, but on the inside, if you turn it inside out, well, there's little threads and things, it's not perfect. Well, French invisible reweaving was actually invented or created to deal with two-sided tapestries that had to be viewed on both sides. And it had to be perfect on both sides. And that's why it was so expensive, and it's become a lost art. And when this first came out, one of the folks in Turin, who's a supposed textile expert, said no such kind of reweaving even exists. And then just a few months after she made that statement, we found a book called French Invisible Reweaving, a Lost Art, or something like that. There's even a book that was done in the 50s trying to preserve what the authors perceived at that point in time was a dying art form. And so why would somebody apply that to the shroud? Well, it was perfected in France by the French court. The shroud was in France at that moment in its history. What more logical object to do that on than something as important to them as the shroud?
And because the threads are then mixed between old threads and new threads, you could have a gradual transition in the chemical composition.
You certainly would. And remember that we don't know the depth or the length of the relief. We don't have any, you know, nobody checked in advance to look for that. And it certainly wasn't expected by anybody. So I think that, that it's fair to say that nobody expected them to look for something like that. What they could have done, however, was taken one more sample from, how about the opposite end of the sheet? In a safe place, but in a place that had no indication of any manipulation at all, and we would have had a point of comparison. Because they only took one sample from that one area, we have nothing to compare it to, so we don't know what the rest of the shroud might tell us if that kind of testing was applied. Any new radiocarbon dating, should it be done on the shroud, they should take that and they should go to different portions of the cloth and remove very small samples that can be then used as reference samples for comparative analysis. You know, if you test one thing and you get that one result, that doesn't prove that the whole cloth is that age. It proves that that corner was that age. And if there was, in fact, interweaving of newer material into the older linen materials that, you know, the original shroud was, you're going to find that the data is going to be skewed dramatically. So, and that's the other thing. You know, we know that this cloth was a pure linen cloth because we looked at it all over with microscopes, with magnifying glasses, and with different types of imaging testing. And, you know, in looking at the shroud, and what we found there was that we don't know whether there's other anomalies on that cloth. It could well be that other areas might have been manipulated. But in the end, testing only one piece in that one corner is not a reliable test that allows you to make a claim of a 95% certainty, which is what the three laboratories claim for their testing. 95% of that sample, perhaps, but not of the shroud itself.
Right, and especially since that sample has a visible difference in the mosaic color photography.
Yeah, and not just there. If you look at my white light photographs that include that corner that I made in 78, you'll see that right where they took the sample from, the cloth is darker, and it gradually lightens up as it goes to the right, consistent with the quad mosaic chemical map, showing a difference there. So even, and here's what was maybe most important, found interwoven into that corner were cotton threads and a dye that had been applied to match the color to the remainder of the cloth. Why did they interweave cotton? Well, cotton can take dye a lot easier than linen, which requires a special treatment for dyes to sort of soak into the linen. It's got a waxy outer surface. And remember, this cloth was redded by the ancient method, so it wasn't done by chemical bleaching the way we do today, which is completely even and, each batch of the linen of the shroud is slightly different because they were done by hand. Each batch was done by hand. But finding cotton interwoven there, we didn't find that anywhere else on the shroud. And there's an indication that the people who did the mending knew exactly how to do it. Then they applied this dye in a gum arabic base. We even know the dye is from the madder root plant, rose madder dye, chemically analyzed. That was found in that corner. Somebody had carefully tried to dye it to match the rest of the color of the shroud and hide their repair. And that's been chemically analyzed, and we know that's there. So, but it also breaks all the rules of Judaism because you can't have cotton interwoven with this, and that would make it trace. It would no longer be the appropriate burial shroud for somebody of high stature.
Yeah, you couldn't even wear it. I mean,
that's right.
You can't even wear clothing that mixes linen with cotton.
Yeah, and people, again, forget the cultural context of the first century. You cannot apply 21st century context to what happened 2,000 plus years ago. And yet people do that every day. So, you know, by today's standards, yeah, we've been educated. We know more about science today. We all have that, you know, some basic understandings of science, and yet they wouldn't have had that knowledge in the first century, nor would some medieval guy think to do any of this. I mean, this is silly to think some medieval person could create this, could paint an image without paint, or make a photographic image without a light-sensitive emulsion, or even scorch an image from a metal statue, which has been one of the other theories. But, you know, we have all these real burns on the shroud from a documented fire in 1532 in Chambéry, France. So we had many scorches on the shroud to use as references. And ironically, a scorched piece of linen, the areas where high temperature has impacted the cloth, will fluoresce in the red when you photograph the cloth with UV fluorescence photography. Interestingly enough, all the real scorches on the shroud fluoresce in the red just like they're supposed to, but the image not only does not fluoresce, it actually quenches the fluorescence of the background of the cloth because the cloth itself has its own fluorescence and more in the yellow. And yet the image not only doesn't fluoresce in the red, it doesn't fluoresce at all, indicating that it is not the product of high temperature. That's been eliminated, and that's in peer-reviewed literature.
Wow. Well, I'd like to hear a little bit about what I don't know if you like the term your ministry, but what you do these days.
But I hear it all the time.
Well, I like it or not, you've been drafted.
Yes, I think so.
So, you know, what kind of groups do you speak to? What is your mission?
Sure. Here's my mission, because I didn't know what my mission was. Remember, I questioned why I was on that team right from the first minute. But in the end, I came to realize that I was given a great privilege to be in that room with this piece of cloth. There were 1 billion people on this planet who had more right to be there than I did, yet for some reason God saw fit to put me there. But it was not about making photographs in 1978. It was about bringing this to a much broader audience 20 years later when the Internet became available. And that's where I found out what my purpose was. It wasn't just to be the documenting photographer, but years later, to be a spokesman for the science that, in my opinion, clearly indicates this is the real thing. And so my ministry is simply about the truth, just about being honest. One of the things that prompted me to build the website was the fact that my friends were calling me up, and one of them called me and said, "Oh, you know that shroud thing you're involved with? Well, that's just a photo by Leonardo da Vinci." And I kind of laughed. I thought he was putting me on, but it turns out a book had come out in 95 that made that claim. I hadn't heard about it, and I asked him, "Where did you get your information?" And he said, "Well, my wife and I were checking out at the grocery store. It was on one of the tabloids." And I had this epiphany at that moment. I realized I was on the inside. I was an insider. I had access to all this data. I had been a participant. I held that cloth in my own hand, left my own DNA all over it as well. And I realized that the public didn't have access to that, and they weren't getting the truth. So I wrote at that moment, while I was still on the phone with the guy, there was a manila folder on my desk, and I wrote, "Consider building a website." And that's when I believe God reached down at that moment of that conversation, said, "Now here's the real plan. This is why you're here. You are going to build that website, and you're going to put this information out there so that anybody who wants it can have access to it. And that way, instead of you trying to pitch the science, you make the science available and let them decide for themselves." And I wrote those very words on the front page of the website over 18 years ago. "Given the facts, we believe you have to make up your own mind about this." And by taking that position, that's what makes it maybe a little less of a ministry, because I'm not telling people what to believe. I'm saying, here are the facts. You have to decide. What does it mean to you?
And what has the effect been on your Jewish faith?
Well, once I went public and started speaking publicly about the Shroud, which started in about 95, 96, I started getting new questions. And the new question was coming from mostly from my Christian and Catholic friends. And they kept saying, "Well, what do you believe?" And they were no longer talking about the Shroud. They were talking about faith. Well, you know, I was raised in an Orthodox home, and we followed the dietary rules, 2 sets of dishes and silverware. My grandfather got up every morning and davened every morning, did his morning prayers, lit the candles on Friday, lit yahrzeit for the people who passed away. So we followed the traditions of Judaism. We were not ultra-Orthodox, but, you know, in the Orthodox vein, I guess, would be the way of putting it. And I never felt very connected to God in those days, but God was still part of everything every day. And so now, as an adult, age 50, 51, I'm forced to confront my own beliefs for the first time, truthfully, as an adult. And when I looked in my heart, I found God had been there all along, just waiting for me to acknowledge him. So I always say this in my lectures. You heard me say this last week. But how many Jews can say it was the Shroud of Turin that led them back to their faith in God? I had walked away from it at age 13 and never looked back. God was not a part of my life for those first 50 years, but he is now. And the connection was more real for me. And you and I talked about this when we were together a week ago. I never felt closer to God in the synagogue or in the beautiful cathedrals that I've been in. I never felt closer to God than when I found him in my own heart. And that became more real to me than anything else.
This is a off the wall question, but you know where I'm coming from. Do you feel prouder about being Jewish because of Jesus?
I certainly, I don't know that I would use that exact words, but I tell you what I've learned. I've learned the connection. I've learned that, and I often say this in my lectures, they refer to our collective faiths as Judeo-Christian. We're only separated by a little hyphen. And I don't feel that separation anymore. And I will also say this, John Paul II, in his calling the Jews the elder brothers of
interfaith, yeah.
And, of course, he recognized the state of Israel, which, of course, made him, he was mourned in Israel when he died, yeah. You know, because he had taken such giant steps in bringing Jews and Catholics back together. And I noticed a difference in the way I was regarded by my Catholic friends after John Paul. I mean, there was a kind of a noticeable love that I hadn't felt before that I started feeling afterwards. And I feel that very much today in virtually every denomination, because I go to Methodists and Lutheran churches, evangelical and messianic churches, non-denominational Christian churches. So I sort of run the gamut, and I can talk about this to any group because I'm not espousing any particular point of view, whether it be Catholic or Protestant or anything like that. I'm just talking about a piece of cloth, the impact it's had on my life, and the fact that people should take a look at this and see what it means for them.
But you presumably don't get invited by synagogues or Jewish groups, do you?
No, I have not. I have Messianic groups, yes, but not Jewish groups, no. And look, I understand that. And you know, I would welcome the opportunity to do it, but I don't expect it. And I can understand why not. I mean, their attitude is very much like my attitude was 35, 36 years ago.
Yeah.
And I get it. I was there too, you know. It took me a long time. I first had to come to terms with the science before I could even get to the faith aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a long time just for the science to finally convince me, but it did. I always quote Arthur Conan Doyle out of the lips of Sherlock Holmes, if you eliminate all the possibilities, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, is most likely the truth. And based on that axiom, I came to accept the Shroud had to be the real thing. Look, my little 90, almost 91-year-old mother, 9 years ago, heard me give a lecture in person for the first time. She was very quiet as we drove home, and I asked her, well, what do you think? And she turned to me and said, well, of course, it's authentic. And I was shocked. This is a 90-year-old woman born in Poland, not well-educated. I said, well, what makes you say that? And she said, they wouldn't have kept it for 2,000 years long to anybody else. It wouldn't have mattered.
They wouldn't have spent all that money on the invisible reweaving.
Exactly. Yeah, she didn't say that, but exactly the point. And I kind of laughed. And then I realized what a profound observation that is. That really is very profound in the sense that, you know, why was this burial shroud kept in secret, hidden away, violation of Jewish law? They couldn't come running out of the tomb and say, look what we found. There were iconoclasts that would have destroyed it and perhaps them too.
Yeah.
And so this is something that had to be kept secret. The first image of Jesus portrayed looking like the man of the shroud was 285 A.D. in the Comitia Catacomb.
Wow.
And that image looks very much like the man of the shroud. If you go a few hundred years later, you'll look at the iconography started by both the Catholic and primarily the Orthodox Church. You'll see that he looks just like the man of the shroud. And a lot of people say, well, yeah, you know, everybody used the last artist rendition as their, you know, for their rendition. But how did it get started? And where we have a bearded man that looks like the man of the shroud. And if you look at the iconography, there are many icons that are very much like the man of the shroud.
Well, some of them even show defects in the shroud, right? Like fold lines, which are really there.
Yeah, there was one or two of them where there's this deep crease under the chin. And the artist incorporated that. Now, they didn't know what it was. So they either tried to make it part of the collar that he was wearing or something like that. But they included it, indicating they'd seen this piece of cloth.
Well, I think this may be my final question, but how has your view of the Catholic Church changed from when you were 18 to when you were 58?
Well, interestingly enough, I was raised raised in a neighborhood that was half Italian, half Jewish. So there were a lot of Catholics there, and the school I went to, the high school I went to, closed for both Jewish holidays as well as Christian holidays, and we had to go 4 extra days before summer vacation began just to make up for that. But But there was never any animosity. We learned about each other's faith. We learned about each other's customs. There was never any animosity or anti-Semitism coming from any of my Catholic friends or any anti-Catholicism going out to them. We just sort of saw that we had different ways of perceiving God, but that we both believed in the same one God. And so I never had any kind of animus toward Christians in any way. I was raised, you know.
And you didn't have a suspicious attitude about the Catholic Church?
No, I never really did. I think perhaps that was just the way we were raised, to have respect for the priests and nuns that we saw, the sisters. My mother taught us that, you know, you give them the same respect you would give the rabbi.
Oh, wow.
And so I never felt any kind of anti-Catholic biases that I can recall. So I never had that as a kind of inherent problem. But, you know, I didn't know much about Catholicism. It wasn't until my involvement got deep with the Shroud and I started spending more time with priests and bishops and deacons and lecturing in churches and staying in rectories, and that I really learned more about Catholicism. And I don't have any animus for Catholics, if anything. I have a great love for them. They've treated me, they've opened up their hearts and treated me and accepted me for who I am, as I am, and I appreciate that and show me great love and respect. And you know, I mean, that's as good as it gets. So I've never had any problems with any of the denominations. I think the evangelicals have been a little more adversarial at times, but I'm now prepared to even answer the questions that they have. And I have a certain part of my lecture, which I didn't give the other day in Florida, there wasn't necessary at a Catholic church. But when I speak in Protestant churches or evangelical Christian venues, I talk about the top five reasons why some Christians are Shroud skeptics. And I address the issues that are most concern to Protestants and evangelicals so that they can understand that, you know, one of the perceptions is that it's a graven image. But we've proven that it's not a man-made image, and a graven image is a man-made artwork that people pray to. And first of all, we've proven it's not man-made, and I've never ever seen anybody pray to the Shroud itself, so that sort of eliminates it. But the real issue is there's an anti-Catholic bias amongst Protestants, of course. And I can say that, I don't mean it as something evil, but it comes from the Reformation, which was getting away from popes and relics and stuff like that. And so I can understand that. But even you know, those folks, when they find out that the Catholic Church has only been in control of the Shroud of Turin since 1985, that sort of disengages that notion that this is some Catholic thing. Or anything, it's a Jewish burial shroud of a man who is believed by a billion people or more to be the prophesied Messiah.
And you never felt any implicit pressure coming from Catholic sources to slant the results or anything?
Not at all. If anything, the church and the king, King Umberto, who'd be owner of the shroud when we examined it in 78, steered clear of any involvement with what we did once we started. They didn't want to put their hands on it. They didn't want it to appear even that they were trying to influence us. That's why they allowed us to own the data we collected. How else do you think that a guy like me gets to be able to make available life-size photographs of the Shroud of Turin? Because the king said, I own those images, much to the chagrin of Turin, I'm sure. They may not be so thrilled that I just, but I'm permitted to do so. And I'm permitted to do so under the agreement that the king signed, allowing us to own the materials we collected.
So if people want to get in touch with you and have you speak or can people actually buy full-size photographs?
Yes,
or?
We have a life-size replica that is available. It's sort of a higher ticket item because they're difficult to make. They're 14 and a half feet, actually 15 feet long with a 14 and a half foot by 3.5 foot wide image on them. And they're made onto a cotton canvas material that allows all the details of my original photograph to be portrayed in the image, to print onto the image. If we went with a more coarse cloth similar to the actual weave of the shroud, then the details of the image wouldn't print. So we had to test about 40 different materials until we could get the very best resolution for my original photographs. And these are natural color photographs, so we call it a replica because it's exactly the way the shroud looked in 1978 when I made those photographs.
And this is all, people can find this stuff via your website?
Correct. On shroud.com, if you go to the website store page, You can see photographs of these replicas on display in a couple different venues. There are several lecturers who travel with these and carry them with them and actually put them on display at their lectures. And there are many of them that are in permanent displays, churches, or in shroud exhibits that are permanent exhibits around the world.
Similarly, to get in touch with you to arrange, you know, perhaps you are addressing a church group or something, is through your website?
Yeah, they can go to the website. Basically, they just need to contact me directly. And by doing so, what we'll do is typically I'm booked about a year in advance for this time of year. So if you want to get me at the Lenten season, best is to plan for the year, the following year, because I'm usually booked up pretty quickly for this time of year. Now, of course, next year, they've just announced in December that the Shroud will go on public display again between 19 April and I believe it's 24 June of 2015. And the dates, I mean, I have them exactly right, but they're posted on the website there. But that will, I'm not booking anything for 2015 until I know when I'm going to be in Turin because I intend to be there. And typically I work with a tour company so that I get to meet a lot of people and people get to hang out with me. I go see the Shroud with different groups and give them private lectures and have meals with them and spend time with them. And it's a fun way for me to get to meet some of the people that I've corresponded with over the last, you know, two decades.
Yeah, I bet the food's pretty good, too.
Yeah, and the food is, you're in Italy, I mean, the food is great. So it's a wonderful thing. But, yeah, people can contact me, and they can just send me by email. There's a page, it's a send us email page. It's got the address and everything. You just hit the button, and it'll pop open your email software and send us an email that way.
Well, let me just put in a little commercial for you. I know that you don't believe in, you know, putting in advertisements for yourself, but I saw Barry Schwartz's presentation just a week or two ago here in Florida, where I live, and I highly recommend it, especially, I mean, any time of the year, but, you know, it's a wonderful element to a Lenten mission or a Lenten, you know, presentation in a parish to kind of enter into the spirit of Lent and enter into, of course, the Passion of Christ. So you might want to think about it already for next year. I'm speaking to the listeners now and maybe get the wheels rolling so that when the time comes, you're high on Barry's list.
Yep, absolutely. As soon as we can, you know, plug in dates, I lock them into the calendar, and that way people can be assured that if I say I can be available on a certain date, I will be.
And I don't know if you do this. I kind of recommend that you do, but if I were you, I think it would be a great idea to make somehow available that people could go to your site and find out what pilgrimage group to the Shroud, when it's on exhibit, includes you or involves you.
There will be a page called Tours to Turin.
Ah, good.
That will come up in a few more months. Right now, the folks in Turin, the Archdiocese, will be creating on their website a page where you can register to go see the Shroud, and you pick the date and the time that, you know, during the event that you want to be there, and you'll get a registration form, and you fill it out, and you're good. You print it out, and you take it with you. I will say this, that the purpose of that is primarily to keep everybody from showing up at 8 a.m. at the cathedral and making a line 100,000 people long like they did in 1978. What the Internet does, and they'll tell you, come at your appointed time, and this way they keep the line shorter. Instead of waiting 10 hours to get in to see the Shroud, you might have to wait an hour, perhaps even two on a busy weekend, but not 10 hours like it was when we were there in 78. There was no Internet at the time, and there was no way of making a reservation. Now you'll be able to do that, and as soon as the reservation page becomes available, then the tour companies will be able to then begin to make their plans and be able to reserve, you know, spaces for their groups. But we can't do that until the Turin authorities get their reservation page online.
Well, I'll put in an advertisement for the Turin authorities and perhaps show a little bit of incorrect bias or prejudice on my part. I was amazed at how well organized it was. As I said, I went in both 98 and 2000, and everything worked like clockwork. It was not my picture of Italian, you know, organization at all.
And what they do really, really well is accommodate people in wheelchairs or disabled. They have a sculpture that you, if you're visually impaired, you can touch it and feel the image of the shroud. And in 2010 was the last public exhibition, and I was there. The organization was even better than it was in 98 and 2000. So they're getting better at it, and I think the Internet has played a great role in them being able to get these reservations set up so that, you know, they don't get flooded at 8 o'clock in the morning with a couple hundred thousand people, which is what happened in 78.
And when you say, like, you might have an hour's wait, I remember they arranged the line that you waited in to be going through, you know, beautiful exhibits on the shroud, so it really set your mind and your heart in the right place for when you actually
to
see it.
They want to indoctrinate you so that when you get to see the actual shroud, which image is quite subtle, so what they have are contrast-enhanced images as you were working your way in the queue, and then you come into one room, it's kind of a big, large auditorium where you stand, and it's dark, and they show you a high-definition film that explains very clearly what all the markings on the shroud are, all this before you actually go in and see the actual shroud. So you've been well indoctrinated, and you know what to look for when you get there.
Mm-hmm. And so meanwhile, you don't feel like you've been waiting at all.
No, because you've actually been kind of experiencing things as you've been, you know, going through the queue there. So I think that they've got it worked out well, but it's a very complex organizational problem they have, and of course they have to have hundreds of volunteers, and traffic is an issue, and parking is an issue. So they, you know, it's a big strain on the city, but at the same time, the city, the state, and even I think that perhaps even the federal government, but certainly the city and the state governments cooperate with each other to make these exhibitions as beautiful as they are.
Very successful. Anyway, do you have anything you want to say before we come to the end of the show?
Well, I would just like to say what a great pleasure it was to finally meet you, Roy, and I'm going to let the audience know that when I first heard from Roy, it was several days before I was coming down to Florida there, and as soon as I saw his name, I knew who he was because four of my Catholic friends over the last probably 4 or 5 years have sent me copies of Roy's book, Salvation is from the Jews. Hint, hint, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, from my Catholic friends. But I thought it was a wonderful opportunity to finally get to meet this man whose name I had known for so long. And so I just want to thank you for coming over to the university and spending 3 or 4 hours sitting there with me just talking about our personal experiences and you know, what got us to where we are today.
Great. Well, I want to thank you very much for actually these two shows. I don't know if you... I didn't reveal that to you, but this will be spread over 2-hour-long shows.
Sure.
And for being, you know, this has been a beautiful experience. And I also, of course, want to thank you for meeting you. I want to thank our listeners for having listened today. And that brings us to the end of this show. I certainly hope you've enjoyed the presentation, so to speak, and all of the details and information and insight from our guest, Barry Schwartz. If you want more, if you want to see some of those incredible photographs and look into some of the facts and subtleties that came up on the show, you can go to his website, www.shroud.com. And if you want the ultimate experience, you can sign up for one of the trips to the Shroud when it's on exhibit late next spring and early summer, which include Barry Schwartz as you know, the speaker on the trip to Turin. So with that, let me thank you and say goodbye and hope you join us again next week on Salvation is from the Jews. Bye for now.
You're tuned to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. The program you just heard was a rebroadcast of Salvation is from the Jews with Roy Schoeman.